Kamloops Alliance, welcome to church. My name's Chris. So glad that you're here. We are in week two of our series, The King and His Cross. My friends, Good Friday is just a few days from now. We have two in-person gatherings here, 9 and 11 a.m. We're going to be live streaming the 11 a.m. as well. So if you're tuning in online, make sure you tune in at 11 on Friday. If I would invite you into the space of Good Friday, one of my professors back in the day said, go and approach Good Friday like you're going to a funeral. Dress in black, be solemn. It's the darkest day in human history when humankind murdered God. The contrast of Good Friday will be met on Sunday with Easter Sunday. My friends, can't wait. Saturday night, 6:30, 9 and 11 next weekend as we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. Pastor Tim Bussey is going to be bringing the message on Easter weekend. It's going to be fantastic. So feel it on Friday and let's celebrate together next weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 6:30, 9 and 11. Glad that you're here. Especially in these days that we're all walking through. COVID-19, I think, is in the rearview mirror, let's hope. And then you got the stuff in Ukraine. And then you have inflation, and then the gas prices, and then the division, and then all of these things. And I think we're all looking for, how do we find peace in the middle of the chaos? How do we find a sense of inner wellness and wholeness in the middle of all of this? I know the mental health stuff and the issues, it's just everywhere in our world. How do you find peace in the middle of the chaos? I think one of the things, probably the most important thing that we can do, is get a fresh vision of who Jesus is. Who is Jesus Christ in the middle of this all? Who is he? Why does he matter? That's what we looked at last week. This week, what we're going to look at is this really important question. What happened on the cross? What is the big deal with the cross? We need a fresh vision of who Jesus is, both in his sovereignty, in his goodness, and being able to provide us with the inner peace that we need, even the peace in our world that we need. In order to do this, we got to answer the question, not just who is Jesus and why does he matter, but what happened on the cross? And so when we talk about the cross, some people are like, man, I'm in. Like, I get it. I love it. I've met Jesus on the cross. And there's other people like, oh, bro, like, we don't got to talk about this. We'd rather have the Jesus that's petting lambs, you know, or the Jesus who's calling the little kids unto himself. Or the Jesus who says, you know, come everybody unto me who are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. And of course, that's a part of the beautiful ministry of Jesus Christ. But important to Christianity is the cross. Important to history is the cross of Jesus. And so we're going to be answering this question, what happened on the cross? So if you're not familiar, if it brings up stuff, you're not the only one. Even from the beginning, the disciples didn't like the cross. Jesus says in Mark three times, look, I'm going to the cross. They're like, no, it can't be you, right? So even from the beginning, the earliest disciples didn't like the cross. In the 1920s and 30s, there seemed to be this kind of split within Protestantism, this idea of more liberal, progressive theology that didn't like the cross, talked about social justice without Jesus and the cross and all. You know, they didn't like it. And then there was this conservative group that really wanted to adhere to the cross. And so one of the thinkers of the more conservative movement of the early 19th or 20th century was H. Richard Niebuhr. He summed up kind of the liberal understanding, the theology of the day by saying this. He said, a God without wrath brought man without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations or the service of a Christ without a cross. And so that's the temptation, is let's just nice things and just pander and all these sorts of things. Let's not talk about the blood. Let's not talk about the cross, you know. And this has really been, the Kingdom of God in America was written in 1934. And so all the way from the beginning, all the way now, the temptation is to not talk about it and to dilute it. When we talk about the cross, we got to talk about human sin. There's churches that don't even want to talk about this anymore. And yet, when we don't talk about it, we end up draining the power from the gospel. So in a world of chaos, how do you experience peace? You experience peace at the cross. So we got to talk about these things. And this is this week. We're going to be doing this from Colossians chapter 1. This is one of the earliest creedal statements of the church as far as who Jesus is and what he has done. So we're going to pick this up in Colossians chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. And here's what we're going to see, that peace is found in Jesus and through Jesus. That the search for peace is found in Jesus Christ. It's in him and it's through him. So let's get going. Colossians 1, verse 19. Here is Paul's continuation of this early hymn. He says, for God, he's talking about here the Father, Father, Son, and Spirit, triune God, co-equal, co-eternal, the Father was pleased. It brought him joy to have all of his fullness dwell. We're going to look at fullness and dwell in a second, but the Father was pleased that this idea that the Father, Son, and Spirit, co-equal and co-eternal, there was never a time where they were not, have been in relationship with each other. And the Father was pleased. It brought him joy to send the Son to do the work of reconciliation. It's a beautiful image about God's love and pursuit. He was pleased at all of this. Anyway, we could get into it, but we got to keep going. For God was pleased to have all of his fullness. Fullness. This word means two things. If you were to look at this word in the original language in the Gospels, what you're going to find in the Gospels is this image of, this is supposed to be a pair of jeans, all right? So bear with me. The image in the Gospels is there's a hole and a patch goes over the hole to fill the hole up. And so if you're to look at my son's pants, he's six. Every single one of his pairs of pants, like 3 days after we get him a brand new pair, hole in it, right? So what this means is that in the Gospels, this word means like there is a patch that completely fills this hole. That's what fullness means. It's fully there. The other term, or the other way it's used, is in Romans. And in Romans, Paul uses this word fullness to bring this idea that Christ fulfills the law, that it is up to, I won't fill it all the way to the top because I'm going to spill it, but it's a fullness. There's nothing lacking in it. It both fulfills the hole that's there and it brings it up to its completion, that God was pleased to have his fullness in these two images dwell. To dwell means to take up residence. That the Father was pleased to have the fullness of God dwell, to take up residence in who? In Jesus Christ. That it is in him that peace comes. That this is the beautiful picture of the gospel, that Jesus is God and all of the fullness is dwelling in him. So Jesus here not only bears God's glory, but all that is God dwells in its fullness in Jesus Christ. So this is kind of a nice concept, but what fulfills it and what brings it even more meaning is if you were to understand and rewind the clock a little bit to the image of the presence of God dwelling and filling the temple. Okay, so to do that, what we're going to do is we're going to go back to Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 44, Ezekiel's a major prophet, and he is visioning the presence of God in the temple. And here's what Ezekiel 44 says. Then the man brought me by way of the north gate into the front of the temple. This is the temple in Jerusalem. This is a vision that Ezekiel has. He says, I looked and saw the glory of the Lord. What? Filling. Right? He fulfills. He's filling it up. The temple of the Lord. And here's the reaction. And I fell face down. My friends, if you were to do just a search in the Old Testament, what you're going to see is that wherever the presence of God is manifesting in its fullness, human beings can't be a part of it. Moses in Exodus says, I want to see your glory. I want to see you. And this beautiful moment happens where God passes, and in the Hebrew, it's Moses just saw the train of his cloak, the train of his robe, and he couldn't handle it. And here, Ezekiel says, the glory of the Lord fills the temple, and I fell face down. Like, human beings can't be in the presence of God without being face down on their face, all right? And here's the remarkable thing about Jesus. Here's what Paul is saying. For God was pleased to have all of his fullness, his glory dwell in him. And in this, God walks around with people. They're not falling face down in front of him. Instead, they're being healed by him. And this is the beautiful thing that Paul is saying, is that peace can be found in Jesus. Why? Because Jesus is fully God. He is fully God. All that is the Father is in the Son, that they are God, the same essence. This is a hope of Christianity. It's the beauty of Christianity. So that may be good for you who are tuning in. You're like, yeah, I'm a believer. I get this, love it, whatever I'm in. But it may be more difficult for you if you're seeking or maybe even a skeptic, this claim that Jesus is God. There's lots who would say that the title of God or the title of deity was given to Jesus after, way after. It was given to him by the church, right? The church kind of needed a power play. And so if they made Jesus God, it would help their cause and they could gain more ground and more political power. Maybe the title of God was given to Jesus by Constantine, right? Early 4th century, becomes emperor. He's like, how do I get more power? And so that's how we're going to call him God, right? Jesus never thought he was God. His earliest followers never thought he was God. This was a title given to him afterwards. And so that may be you. Now, this is more popularized in Dan Brown's book called The Da Vinci Code. All that sort of stuff. Here's a problem with that, though. The problem with that claim is that history doesn't say that. History doesn't give us that. In fact, we have 17 non-Christian sources outside of the New Testament that give us information about Jesus between 100 and 150 years after his life. 17 sources outside the New Testament. These are not biblical sources that give us facts, insights, about 60 of them, into Jesus, his life, his followers, all that sort of stuff. 17 of them, of these 17, 6 mention his deity. Let me give you one. Pliny the Younger, he was a Roman governor in modern day Turkey. All right. He had Christians in his city. They would not bow to the Roman gods. He had problems with them. So he wrote a letter to the Emperor Trajan, basically saying, this is my problem. This is how I'm going to deal with them. What are your thoughts? Okay. And we have this letter. It was written in 112 AD. This is, you know, Jesus died, resurrected around 34, 35 AD, the birth of the church all the way to about the 60s, 70s. The Gospel of John written, we think, in about the 90s. AD. So this is within the first generation after the apostles where this was written. So in 112 AD, Pliny the Younger writes this. He's a Roman governor, writes this to Trajan in 112. He says, they, the Christians, were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day. He's talking about Sunday, Easter Sunday morning, before it was light, when they sang, we've always been singing people, in alternate verses, a hymn to Christ. Then what does he say? As to a God, and bound themselves by solemn oath not to any wicked deeds, for which it was their custom to separate and then reassemble to partake of food, talking about communion on an ordinary and innocent kind. Now, my point is this, that to Pliny, he sees these early Christians worshiping, they're singing a hymn to Christ as to a God. Now, Pliny's not saying that he believes that Jesus is God, but what he is saying is that the earliest followers in 112, a generation after the apostles, are singing to Jesus as if he was a God. The claim that the church or the Council of Nicaea or Constantine, all of a sudden, you know, the 3-4 centuries after, like, oh, he's going to be God now. It's just not true. It doesn't bear witness in 112. These earliest Christians were singing to Jesus as if he was a God. You're like, who cares? Here's why this matters. Is because if he is God, then we can find peace in him. If he is not God, don't worry about Christianity. Just move on. But if he is God, something has to be explored. Peace can be found in Jesus, and peace can be found through Jesus. here. And through him, this is Paul continuing in verse 20, to reconcile to himself all things. We're going to look at reconcile. We're going to look at all things. Then he says, whether things in earth or things in heaven. This is, again, the scope of his reconciliation. It's everywhere. By making peace, this is the third thing, by his blood shed on the cross. Let's start with reconcile. To reconcile means that there is complete harmony. Complete harmony. That in Jesus, God was reconciling everything to himself. A reconciliation is a beautiful image. It's the image of people who were enemies coming together as friends. Reconciliation is the restoration of relationship. There was a problem, the problem has been solved, and the people are now together again. See, reconciliation involves forgiveness, but it's more than that. It's more than that because it's not just I forgive you and we go our separate ways. No, no, no. Reconciliation means that these two parties that were once like this have come together and are now like this. And what Paul is saying is that through Jesus, he's going to reconcile to himself all things, all things. Now, here's the difficulty, though, because reconciliation assumes that there's a problem. Assumes that there's something wrong that has made this division happen. So here we need to talk about the Christian understanding of sin, the Christian doctrine of sin. And for some of you who are new to this, you're shuddering. You're like, oh no, sin, it's not a four-letter word, but it's close. It is very, very close because it's a real confrontation or an affront to our modern sensibilities. And I understand. Let me just say this before we get into talk about sin. Sin is kind of like the cough syrup Buckley's, right? It tastes awful, but it works. It works here in the sense that it explains what is wrong with the world. Man, what's wrong with us? What's going on? What's happening, right? Christianity says sin, it explains what's wrong. And I would just say, if you're not a believer, if you're a seeker, you're a skeptic, I would just say you have to have an answer for what's wrong. Why are things the way they are? Both from the smallest to the grandest, biggest level. Christianity's answer to that, to the problem or to the question of what is wrong is this idea of sin. So the beginning of the Bible talks about this. It's this kind of federal representative story of humanity's relationship with God. God makes our first parents, Adam and Eve, in his image and in his likeness, loved in relationship. There's peace and shalom with them and God, with themselves, with each other, and with the cosmos. In Genesis chapter 3, the whole thing is fractured. Love demands free will. These humans made in the image of God turn their back from God and go their own ways. We can do it on our own. We want to be like you. You're holding out on us. And so in their pride and their idolatry and in their unbelief, they turn and they do their own thing. And this fracture has caused chaos in the world. They are no longer in relationship with God. Their relationship with themselves is fractured. Their relationship with each other and their relationship with the cosmos, with the universe is also, their world has also been fractured. So sin is a fracturing. It's the sense that not all is as it should be, both with myself, with others, with the world, and with, and most importantly, with God. And this, my friends, makes the world makes sense. And what is wrong? Christians say sin, rebellion against God, the fracturing of our world. And this has had implications in every sphere of our existence. Ecologically, with our world, there's been earthquakes and climate disasters. Sociologically, the way that we interact together, the sociology of your office, which is so toxic, the sociology of your family tree with all of the generational issues and addictions is unhealthy. Culturally, it was so ironic that the tagline of COVID was like, we're all in this together. It's like, no, we're not. Not at all. Everybody is out for themselves. That culturally, we're broken. We're fractured, turning in on ourselves and away from other people. There's an ethnocentrism, even sociologically, there's an ethnocentrism culturally that we have that we just believe that everybody should think and look and act as we do in our own culture. Politically, we see the effects of sin in geopolitical strife and war. Economically, the poorer get poorer. You see the inequalities, even with the COVID vaccines, with economics, that the rich countries could afford, and so we move on, and yet countries in Africa struggle to even move forward. We see the effects of sin in biology, with viruses, COVID-19 itself, with cancer and with death. Now, what I'm not saying here is that your sin causes your cancer. No, this is the fracture of the created order. The anthropology, what it means to be a human being with our desires, our messed up desires, our misinformed desires for sex and for power, for money and for things. With the way that we deal with even our anger or our addictions, the good that we want to do and we can't, the change we want to experience, but we don't. The selfishness that leads to our divorce and the anger that leads to murder and the lust that leads to adultery. The Bible is going to say not one person is good. That all of us are under this reality. That things in the created order, Romans says that the creation was subjected to futility because of sin. That us, our relationships, and with God are all broken. And my friends, this dismantles the modern notion of, I'm a good person. I'm a good person. I always want to ask, who are you comparing yourself to? Are you comparing yourself to Mother Teresa? Or are you comparing yourself to Hitler? See, when you compare yourself to God, when you compare yourself to Jesus, in whom God dwells in his fullness, my friends, we fall face down because of our sin. This is the pain that through him, he has to reconcile sinful humanity to himself. But what, here's the hope, is he's reconciling to himself what? All things are being reconciled to Jesus, in whom God dwells fully. That in verse 16, all things were created by him, through him, and for him. And now Paul says that he's going to reconcile those all things to himself. That this reconciliation is complete harmony with all things, economically, socially, culturally, politically, our anthropology, our biology, that everything that is fractured is made right. Everything that is broken is made whole because of the reconciling work that Jesus does. Now, that brings up questions. You're like, it doesn't seem like it's reconciled, bro. Here's the thing, is that the way that God is reconciling to himself all things right now is through reconciled people. Is through people, if you follow Jesus, like me, who we are given the task, it says in 2 Corinthians, of reconciliation. That our job is to be reconciling agents everywhere we go, both with policy making as well as loving our neighbor as ourselves. That God's plan A to reconcile the world to himself, all things, is through you and I and his church. And the reality is that there are some spheres and some places where it doesn't seem like he has reconciled all things. You know, if you're honest, even for me, I see these pictures coming from Eastern Europe, and it's like, it doesn't seem like there's complete harmony. It seems very much broken. This is a Christian understanding that these things have already come, but they have not yet come in their fullness. So we live here in this awkward time between the ages, between the anchors of our hope that he has come and he is going to come again. And my friends, when he comes again, he is not coming as a baby in a cradle or a crucified savior on a cross. He comes as judge. And so the reconciliation at the end is going to be imposed on people where now it's invitational. And Jesus will come to judge the living and the dead. And all of these realities and all of the atrocities and all of the war crimes will be punished and will be judged because of who Jesus is. He is reconciling himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven. How? What's the effect of the reconciliation? It's peace. That is, reconciliation brings peace. reconciling all things by making peace, complete harmony. The enemies come together as friends. That God has sent Jesus to provide peace. In other words, if you want the peace experientially, that God has to come to you in Jesus Christ to die so that you could have the peace you're looking for. My friends, you can't do it yourself. The Christian gospel, the good news of Jesus is that you can't do this by yourself, but he's done it for you. He's done it for you. That because of our sin, we can't be friends with the holy God, but Jesus comes as God and pays the penalty for sin, which brings us into a legal, peaceful relationship with God, covered in the righteousness of Christ, human and God, perfect in his nature, dies for us so that we could know God in a legal sense, the righteous for the unrighteous, and we're clothed because of him in his righteousness. We have peace with God in our standing with him and peace with God in our experience of him, from the chaos of the world to a sense of peace, to a sense of the world being right. Not despite the world, but in the mess of our time. Here's the hope of Christianity, is that you can experience peace. The New Testament book of Philippians is going to say that this is a peace that passes understanding. Like it doesn't make sense. I believe in Jesus for a lot of different reasons. I believe that he is historical. I believe we know that he is God. There's good reason to believe that this is all true. But I also believe in Jesus because of the experience that I have myself and as a pastor as well. As a pastor, I have sat with people in the worst moments that life can bring. The worst. I've sat with people who have lost their daughter because of the opioid crisis and an overdose. And in the middle of their pain and in the middle of their grief and questions and the would've, could've, and should've, their hope and their source of peace is Jesus Christ. I've sat with people who literally had just come from the doctor's office to my office, getting their diagnosis of cancer and not knowing what the future was going to hold. And in the midst of all of the pain and all of the questions, there's a sense of peace. Not despite the bad news, but in the bad news, they can experience peace because of their reconciled relationship to Jesus Christ, because of his sovereignty, because of the hope that he's going to reconcile all things to himself. I've sat and talked with people who are planning their own funeral because they know what's coming. And with tears in their eyes, lamenting the journey of life being over, they have a sense of peace that it is all going to be okay because Jesus has reconciled all things to himself. That the greatest penalty of sin is death, and that's been taken away because of Jesus. I've sat with people who have buried their spouse after decades of marriage and now face life alone. And in the middle of the tears, not despite the situation, but in it, they can have peace. How does this happen? It happens because these people have placed their trust and hope in Jesus, in whom the fullness of God dwells, in whom he's reconciling all things to himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven. He's reconciling and making peace with cancer and with death and with divorce and the worst things of life, my friends. You can experience peace in Jesus and through Jesus. How does this peace come? The means is here, number four. The means, the effective agent of this peace is his blood shed on the cross. His blood that is shed on the cross. That the basis of Christ's reign of peace is his blood that was shed. If all things are reconciled, are made whole and complete and in harmony again through the blood of Jesus, then my friends, the cross is truly the pivotal point of human history. It's not something that we just think about once a year. It's not a seasonal interest. Rather, it's the turning point, the fulcrum point of human history. Because on the cross, God took upon himself that which stood as a barrier between humanity and took it upon himself. And that the worst that sin could do is kill. And Jesus has exhausted that power. And the blood is the effective agent of this reality. Here is what has to happen for reconciliation to happen between you and God. Is that a price had to be paid. A sacrifice had to happen. A sacrifice that you could not do on your own. But Jesus, who being fully human and fully God, goes and pays the debt and penalty of sin for you. That a price has to be paid. In any typical human situation of forgiveness and reconciliation, a price has to be paid. That the offended party has to make a decision about what to do moving forward. On November 8th, 1987, it was Remembrance Day, is in a small Northern Ireland city of Enniskillen. They were gathering for Remembrance Day ceremonies. At the time, there's a lot of strife with the IRA. The IRA had planted a 40-pound bomb in this cenotaph public place, and it exploded, killing 11 people and injuring 64 more. It was absolutely horrendous. One of the people who was killed was a woman named Marie Wilson. Marie was a local nurse. And as she was in the rubble of all of the impact of the bomb, her dad was also there, but not in as bad shape as her. Marie's last words to her father was, "Daddy, I love you very much." And she died. Gordon Wilson now was faced with the future without his daughter. What was he going to do? The offense and the pain, the hurt of all of this. I'm sure the impulse is to want to get revenge, to want to get back. But shortly after this horrendous moment, this tragic moment, the worst nightmare for any parent, shortly after, he gave this interview to the BBC. And here's what he says. He says, "I bear no ill will. I bear no grudge. Dirty sort of talk is not going to bring her back to life. She was a great wee lassie. She loved her profession. She was a pet. She's dead. She's in heaven, and we shall meet again. I will pray for these men tonight and every night." Gordon Wilson became an image of reconciliation and forgiveness in the middle of the worst thing. The forgiveness that he offered, the price that he had to pay to forgive, changed history. The organization that was responsible for planting this bomb issued a formal apology after this. His pleas for peace and the example of forgiveness prevented the reprisals, the back and forth, because he took it upon himself and he paid the cost of forgiveness and reconciliation. And my friends, this Easter, it is through Jesus, he's reconciling all things to himself by making peace through his blood that was shed on the cross, that God is the one in Christ who takes the penalty of your sin upon himself. And because of what he has done, we can find peace. Peace with God. Peace with ourselves. Peace with our past. Peace with our friends. Peace with our family. And peace in the middle of all the chaos of this world. Through Lent, my family has been reading a children's version of the 1684 spiritual classic, The Pilgrim's Progress. It was written by John Bunyan in 1684. At one point, it was one of the most published Christian works of all time. You can still buy the book today. I would recommend it. It's a kind of allegorical journey of Christian who's a protagonist. I want to read you two pages of this children's book to you. I read it to my kids last week and did so with a tear in my eye when we think of Easter and what it all means. Here's Christian's journey to the cross. The author says, he ran until he reached a hill where he saw a large wooden cross. His book told him that the king's son had died on this cross so that little pilgrims could be freed from their burdens. Christian's eyes filled with tears. He thought how much it must have hurt the king to send his only son to die and how much pain the son must have endured while dying. Christian stood in wonder. I live my whole life in the city of destruction. I continually disobeyed the king. I never once thanked him or showed him any love. I'm a poor little pilgrim in filthy clothes. Why would he do this for me? As he drew near to the cross, the straps on his shoulders snapped and the huge load, his burden, fell off his back. It rolled down a hill, picking up greater speed until it fell into a large pit, never to be seen again. Christian beamed with joy. He was finally free. His heart was full of love for the king's son. He died so I can live. He was broken so I can be made whole. He endured the worst to give me the best. My friends, instead of the cross being this idea of derision, instead of sin being the thing that we hate to talk about, it's actually at the cross where we find the best news ever given to you. Because it is here where the burdens of your life and the grace of Jesus meet, and you can become free and at peace. So here's what this means for you. We often think about God being the one who requires that we got to do certain things before he's going to love us, right? We got to clean up our lives. We got to get ourselves and stuff figured out before we come to him. But no, the gospel, my friends, blows this up. The Bible rather presents God who has loved us before we've done anything, and he provides himself to save us. That the search for peace is found in Jesus, where we go from defiance in our pride, our idolatry, and our unbelief to faith and trust in who he is and what he has done. We go from being enemies to friends, from being lost to being found, from worshiping little things to worshiping him. We go from chaos to peace. And this is the hope of reconciliation. God in Christ, in which all of his fullness dwells, God is pleased that it dwells in him, has taken and done everything to be reconciled to you, to give you the peace that you're looking for. My question is, are you doing your part to meet him there? My friends, the only part you have to do is faith and trust and belief in who he is. Lord, I pray for my friends that this would be a step towards Good Friday and next weekend, that we would be intrigued and we would want more. For those of us who are tuning in, who love you, Lord, I pray that the gospel would be a balm to our soul, would be like water in the desert for one who is thirsty, that we would be reminded again that it is not by us that we are saved and loved, but all because of the Father's plan to send the Son to die in our place for our sin, that we would be reconciled and at peace. Lord, for those who are seeking, for those who are unsure, I pray that you would give them the courage they need to take the next small step. Ask the question, maybe even pray the prayer, that they would even tune in on Friday and come on Easter Sunday and rejoice. We thank you that all things are being reconciled. We love you, Lord. In your name I pray. Amen. Bless you. Thanks for being here. See you on Friday.